I did title this Being Independent and Being Interdependent. This is us going to take a quick look at the 689, chapter 26, paragraphs 14 through 15, but I'm going to be stating it in the context of what kind of are some church issues that we're having right now. We do need to decide whether we want to be formally associational or not, and that is a, in some sense, an easy question, in some sense, a complicated question. So my method for this is I know all y'all here know the theology of the church. We know what we believe. I do want to bring out some of those assumptions that I'm coming to when we ask these questions, when we discuss this. And so you're going to see a lot of verses up there. I'm probably not going to read them because I don't think I'm going to have time, because I do want to leave plenty of time for questions, plenty of time for even discussion if we have. And I also do want to get through all the material I have. I may also just skip over large chunks of it if I don't deem it appropriate for now. So with that, let's look at this. So what are we assuming when we come to this question? Well, first, we are assuming that Christians have professed to believe in the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. This, of course, has taken place since the Nicene Creed of 325 AD. And two, Christians are invisibly united by the apostolic gospel in the holiness of justification and faith. I remember one of my second sermons I ever preached here, probably 10 years ago, was on Ephesians 4, those first couple of verses that deal with that. Three, what are we assuming? Local churches alone are invisibly united by the apostolic doctrine and visibly united by the apostolic authority of the keys of the kingdom. That first unity that I talk about there, Christians possess the first kind of unity by virtue of their membership in the new covenant. This is you being in relation to Christ. And second, that second unity occurs when the new covenant is publicly ratified and administered before the onlooking nations with kingdom authority, and that would be what a church does when it constitutes together. Apostolic doctrine unites Christians and churches. Apostolic doctrine and apostolic office, that's talking about authority, the keys of the kingdom, if you will, unite a church. And a lot of this that I'm getting, just so you all know, comes from this excellent book, Baptist Foundations, Church Government for an Anti-Institutional Age. It's edited by Mark Dever and Jonathan Lehman. A lot of authors go there. This is probably the best book on Baptist ecclesiology, especially dealing with modern day issues, that I have ever read. And secondly, another book I'm using a lot is Associational Churchmanship, which comes from ARPGA. I believe someone bought these for everyone to have, so I'm not going to go into too much detail about this. It's going to be part of your homework to kind of read, but I will give a high-level overview of that. Four, churches are formally independent. And this is what it means for us to have apostolic office and local authority in the church alone. That means churches are formally independent. And five, it means that Christians must be united to a local church. Then, of course, we believe in church membership, so I'm not going to go into more detail about that. Now, when I say the word independent, I do want to be clear that I don't say that that means churches can do whatever they want. They're kind of just their own whatever. We're under the authority of Christ, obviously. Another word you probably hear for this often is the word autonomy. Autonomy does not mean we can thumb our noses at everyone else and claim everything belongs to us. There is a point to the doctrine of the autonomy of the church, and it is that Christ has set within the church everything it needs to accomplish its purposes, or his purposes, that is, Christ's purposes, for it. And of course, they have to be his purposes, right? They can't just be whatever we think of willy-nilly. And this is, of course, what we practice. We don't have popes, councils, bishops, anything like that, synods, that are over us in an authoritative fashion, right? That's basic Baptist belief. That is one of the defining marks of Baptist, really. A lot of people might think it has to do with baptism. Baptism is for sure one of them, but that relates to their view of church government. So again, these are all things we're assuming, so I want to make sure we bring these out so we don't jump into, you know, associations without having this basic understanding. And that was from that book, Associational Churchmanship. Local churches are independent, that is, autonomous, because they possess authority over their own membership and statements of faith. That is that the churches agree of what they're going to confess, as what faith they're going to confess, and whatever detail you'll go into that. We have a much more detailed confession than some other churches. And again, I could go into a 15-part class on ecclesiology, but I'm going to just give this really high-level overview here. We know we work against, as a church, the world, the flesh of every member, and the devil. The devil does not want our church to be united or to succeed or things like that. And it would be wise of us then to join other churches. You know, how do we do that? And that's kind of what I want to look at. So we do know and understand that we are independent in the sense that I explained there, but Are there any examples in the Bible of how we are interdependent? And I wanted to bring out some more. You know, Pastor Dill last week brought a lot out of the one another's. I wanted to bring out specifically now just some of the verses that may talk about the churches in regards to this. So first, different churches shared love and greeting. All the churches greet you. Again, you can see all those verses there. I will link to this PowerPoint in the sermon notes. That way, if you want to analyze more of these verses in detail, you can. Two, they shared preachers and missionaries. With him, we're sending the brothers out. It's famous among you in all the churches, 2 Corinthians, and we also see that a big part of 3 John there. Three, they supported one another financially with joy and thanksgiving. At present, however, I'm going to Jerusalem, bringing aid to the saints. And we see Paul collecting for the poor church in Jerusalem that was in need. And also your ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God, 2 Corinthians. Four, they imitated one another in Christian living. You became, and this is Paul talking to the Thessalonica, the church in Thessalonica, you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. And again, we see these examples all throughout Thessalonians. These are things that we see, these are really just testimonies we see of how churches knew about each other, were working with each other. But we not only have those testimonies, we also do have some direct exhortations as well. Five, the churches were told to greet one another, greet also the church in their house, Romans 16:5. Six, they were instructed to care for one another. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. Each of you is to put something aside and so forth. We see those commands to help out other churches. And also, in that was 1 Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians, he does mention also, so give proof before the churches of your love and of your boasting about you to these men. He is talking about fiscal support there. Seven, they were cautioned about whom to receive as teachers. You have the command, you know, do not believe, you know, every spirit, but test the spirits. And this is in a context of when there's traveling preachers around, churches are sharing preachers and whatnot. And also the exhortation to watch yourself in 2 John. You know, don't destroy what we've been building up with our churches and whatnot. Eight, they were exhorted to pray for other churches. Keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints. Ephesians 6. Summary of this, the point is impossible to evade. Local congregations of the New Testament were very much integrated with one another. Local churches possess independence because they possess authority for representing Christ, pronouncing a confession, and initiating the Great Commission. So that's those three things, Christ, representing Christ, pronouncing a confession, and initiating the Great Commission, those three C's there, that's a good, you know, pastoral rhetoric there, help us understand why the church is independent, because we have that authority as a congregation. By similar measure, the interdependence that is churches working together of local churches is founded in the fact that they share the same Christ, the same confession, and the same commission as well. And that, again, is from that Baptist Foundation's book. So separate churches sharing the same Christ. Again, I'm going to skip over a lot of these verses just for time's sake. I'll just read the first verse. To the church of God that is in Corinth, call to be saints together with all those who in every place call upon the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, both their Lord and our Lord. Again, this is all basic theology. We understand this. We're all fellow citizens, so forth and so on. Now, what are the implications that we share the same Christ? Well, one, Christians should care about polity since it determines how unity is made visible in the church. That's more dealing with membership. Two, the names and reputations of all Christians in churches are bound together. This is unfortunate, even if they're in different denominations. I know sometimes we have to deal with that crazy Baptist church that, you know, pickets or Baptist. I air quote Baptist and I air quote church. You know, the people who picket at the Westboro Baptist Church. There you go. Unfortunately, I've had coworkers ask me about that. Like, oh, hey, you're Baptist also. What do you think about these guys? And, you know, we unfortunately are tied, at least to the world, we're tied just by name. But anyways, I'll let that, I'll keep going. Because churches share an interest in one another's spiritual welfare, they should pray for one another, encourage one another, financially support one another as opportunity allows, and generally do what they can to support one another's mission. Doing this does help safeguard against, you know, turfiness or isolationism or thinking that, you know, we're the only ones that have the truth and whatnot. There was a famous sermon called Pray for Revival in the Other Guy's Church, and he dealt with a lot of these things and talked about it in 3 John, how, you know, who was it in 3 John? It was Gaius. He loved to support, you know, the faithful missionaries and whatnot, but Diotrephes, he loved to be first, and And there's obviously several curses that came along with that. He was not blessed in that. So it's good for us to recognize, yes, there is a universal church. We're not the only true church. We should be praying for other churches in these ways. 4, different levels of cooperation are possible based on different levels of doctrinal and ecclesial unity. We could work with another church in sheltering victims, since we would all have the same goal of protecting life, right? It wouldn't really matter too much. And again, that's going to depend on a lot of our view of what that church is doing and what they're exactly representing. We could work with the Presbyterian Church in preaching the gospel, but not planting churches, because we do have the same confession, but we don't have the same polity, right? We have the same gospel, but we don't have the same polity of how a church is going to act, look, and function. So we could do a conference with them, things like that. And see, we could work with another Reformed Baptist church to share the gospel and to plant churches. And that's because we do share the same gospel and the same confession and the same polity. Separate churches share the same confession. Again, we see, if anyone preaches another gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. There's an assumption Paul has that churches believe the accurate, correct gospel. And John also expects every church to embrace the right doctrine of the incarnation, 1 John 4. And there's a lot more examples we could go through than that. So what are some implications of separate churches sharing the same confession? Well, 5, churches should partner in learning from one another and teaching one another. Guest preachers, missionaries, seminaries, we support good book publishers. They're not necessarily Reformed Baptists. We get a lot of great stuff from Ligonier. It could go on and on and on. We even at one time, had our pastor preaching at another church when they didn't have a pulpit. Remember, he was preaching every week. This is also a good encouragement for us to learn from church history, recognizing that Jesus was also Lord over those churches. What can we learn from them? There's a lot of really good church history that could help us in a lot of our dilemmas, if you will, or questions we might have. 6, churches should imitate one another in holiness, like the apostolic churches did. And again, this is some of the benefits of going to multi-church conferences, books, various networks, associations, and whatnot. And I even recall that almost every time we've had another church help us out, behind the scenes, whether it's a counseling issue or discipline issue, a lot of them were people that we had met at different church conferences or in different networks or associations that we may have attended, that we weren't formally a part of, but we attended. All right, so separate churches share the same commission. This is the last point on this. All churches are called to be holy, 1 Corinthians 1, called to make disciples, that's again the Great Commission in Matthew 28, and tasked with guarding the name and reputation of Christ through church discipline, Matthew 18, and also you can look at the several verses in 1 Corinthians about that, and 2 Corinthians regarding church discipline. So what are some implications of separate churches sharing the same commission? Well, 7, churches should work together regarding membership and discipline. Now, as good congregationalists, we don't believe that any church can exercise authority over any other church, but I can personally testify, and I remember times when I would initiate calls or receive calls or emails or face-to-face conversations where we were dealing with someone's transfer of membership. Like, oh, yes, a pastor would call us and ask about a member who was asking to join their church. And be like, oh, yeah, that person left in good standing. They're a great resource in this way. You should really bug them about playing guitar. They do that if you need any help. And we would just have a good conversation, to kind of pass the baton, if you will, to make sure that they were still under authority, make sure that they were still under, accountability. And you also see biblical examples of that in Romans 16, the commendation there given by Paul. 8, churches should work together in missions and evangelism. This can happen at a local level or on a more global scale, like ARPCA. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And again, that's because they share the same commission. So, how are ways that they can join together? And 9, churches should partner together in their mercy ministries. We saw an example of that, when Paul's pooling all the resources to help the church in Jerusalem, the church in need. So then what is all this business about associations? And, why formal, why informal? That's what I want to look at next. But at this point, are there any questions? Because this is just kind of the underlining theology, the underlining assumptions we have kind of going into associationalism. All right, so let's look at our confession now on these paragraphs in question. I also will explain why some Reformed Baptists have a difference in how they view this particular part. And one of the reasons we have to kind of decide, because I've known some Reformed Baptist pastors who, they're going to answer the call to fill the pulpit, or rather to be the pastor at a specific church, And one of their requirements, you know, regarding their own personal convictions was that, okay, well, this church needs to be part of a formal association, you know, and the church agreed with that, and then that happened. I also know of other churches that would, or other pastors who would not be a pastor if the church was formally a part of an association because of their own personal convictions on that. So let's dive into that debate just a little bit. And again, if we have questions on that, we can look at that more, but I think this may cover it all. So our own confession reads in chapter 26, paragraph 14, "As each church and all the members of it are bound to pray continually for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ in all places," and this is basically going to summarize all the verses and what I was kind of summarizing before, "and upon all occasions to further it, everyone within the bounds of their places and calling in the exercise of their gifts and graces, so the churches, when planted by the providence of God, so as they may enjoy opportunity and advantage for it, ought to hold communion among themselves for their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification." Of course, it has all the verse references there. And you can see that bolded section, "hold communion among themselves." That does show up in the next paragraph as well. And this paragraph is in the paragraph dealing with the church. It's dealing with a lot of how members are to relate to each other, church membership, things like that. This is the paragraph that begins the discussion about interchurch relationships or how should churches associate and whatnot. So let's look at that next paragraph before we dive a little more into this. 15 reads, "In cases of difficulty or differences, either in point of doctrine or administration, wherein either the churches in general are concerned or any one church in their peace, union, and edification, or any member or members of any church are injured in or by any proceeding in censures not agreeable to truth and order, it is according to the mind of Christ that many churches holding communion together," there's that phrase in question again, "do by their messengers meet to consider and give their advice in or about that matter in difference to be reported to all the churches concerned." Again, that question is on the holding communion together. "Howbeit, these messengers assembled are not entrusted with any church power properly so called, or with any jurisdiction over the churches themselves to exercise any censure either over any churches or persons, or to impose their determination on the churches or officers." And that's just basically saying, yes, we're good congregationalists. We want to seek advice from, you know, churches that we are in league with, that agree with us on many, many things, but we recognize they can't have the authority. You know, an elder in another church does not have any kind of proper authority, jurisdiction. You know, they can give us advice, and we can only take it as advice. They can't say that's how it is, and if you don't do that, then you're unchurched, or you're unpastored, or you're unmember-sized, whatever. They don't have that power. And that is how all the Reformed Baptist and Baptist associations work. Oh, I shouldn't say all Baptists, because I don't know them all. So the question comes down to this, and this is James Ranahan. He says, "From my perspective, the real question is not should we have associations, because whether formal or informal, they already exist. The question is simply what kind of association shall we have?" And I can personally testify to this. I know I've gone to the Trinity Montanville Pastors Conference before, and they don't have formal associations. But if you didn't know that, you would look at them and see them, how they interact, and how they're fulfilling everything we just read in the confession, and you would be like, wow, this is a great, how do I join up with this association? It's like, oh, we're just churches getting together, you know, in an informal way. Like, we have schedules and plans and things like that, but we don't have an outside, separate church body that organizes this or anything like that. So again, it's just natural for us to form these associations. You've heard, I don't know if you heard Pastor Dell when he says, yeah, you know, we became Reformed Baptist and we were instantly looking for, you know, okay, what other churches believe like us? And they were looking for other people like that. It's natural for us to want to seek help, especially in more, you know, Reformed doctrinal matters that is sometimes especially hard to find in, you know, Reformed Baptist camps and whatnot. So what are the various views of holding communion together? We're just going to basically look at the for and against. So for those four formal associations, we will say that it does not, they will say that it does not violate Scripture. Rather, we see a precedence for it. And they basically, you will use the paradigm of church membership, just as members should formally join up. You know, that way the pastor knows for sure who they're accountable for. That way members are, you know, are covenanted together. They know, you know, there's, you know, basically sign the dotted line. And when I'm talking about formal associations, that's what I'm basically talking about, is that there's some kind of constitution or something that will formally bind the churches together. And I say bind, I mean link them up in arms, because again, there's no authoritative binding there. For those who are not for formal association, some of them will say that it actually violates the regulative principle of worship. That is, in church, we only do what Scripture commands, and there is no clear teaching for us to formally join together like this with a supra-church or a para-church structure. Since there's no scriptural precedent for it, thus they can't do it in good conscience. And again, this is why some Reformed Baptist pastors will say, well, you know, that's where I land, and so if you guys are formally a part of that, I couldn't in good conscience be your pastor, because I would see that as wrong. I would see that we're doing something wrong. Now, I also want to make the point that I know I would talk to Jay at least once a year, because we always go to the Texas Area Association Reformed Baptist Churches. We were getting lots of benefit from it. You know, I wanted to do a presentation like this for years and years and years. One reservation that Jay had at the time was that he was afraid that, you know, because we would always, he would always go and he would take some of the other men. Like, I know Dennis has gone. I myself have gone to the Trinity Montville Pastors Conference, and they are not a part of a formal association. But it's kind of like how I joke about Calvary Chapel. It's a non-denominational denomination. You know, they're very strict in saying, no, we're non-denominational. But practically, they're kind of their own denomination. It's similar with the churches that attend Montville. You know, they work very closely together. I believe they fulfill all these things in the confession. But again, they keep it as an informal association. Anything that is run goes through the church. So Trinity Montville, that church is what does the pastor's conference. There'll be another church that runs and organizes the family camp. You know, if any books come out, it's through a church. It's not through a association, although they will support each other in doing it. So it kind of practically looks like an association, and it is, I think. It's just an informal one. But I also want to add that I think there has been some misunderstanding that people think whenever you decide one way or the other, you're ousted from the other side. And I ran a Reformed Baptist. This is kind of when I was studying out Reformed Baptist in greater detail. I want to know more about it. I wanted to talk to a lot of the pastors. That's when I started that blog and podcast, Confessing Baptist. I forget how many years I did it. I want to say 5. Did almost 100 interviews with different pastors on different sides of this issue and all across the spectrum. And I can honestly say I never got the impression from any one of them that because they have a pastor friend down the street that is the opposite view of them on associations, that they didn't fellowship with them, or that they didn't call them up for advice, that they didn't do that. You know, if they were in the same proximity, in a similar proximity, they would still fellowship. And yes, they weren't formally tied, or sometimes they were formally tied in other ways, in other pastoral networks. But I think it is a myth that you pick one side or the other, and you have to oust everyone else out. I remember when I became an elder here, before I needed to step down several years ago, we had a pastoral advisory committee. We got 7 pastors from 5 different churches on either side of this issue, and they were working together. And it really, I'm going to say a cheesy Texas phrase, it blessed my heart, you know. But I mean, it really did. I was very encouraged to see these, because I had kind of heard those whisperings or myths, and I just haven't seen it to be true. In all my time talking with these men, you know, not only have I interviewed them, you know, over the phone and things like that, like I said the other day, like, I've been at their house, you know, had dinner with a lot of these guys, hung out with conferences, hung out late nights with men on both sides talking about these things. And yes, there is a difference in methodology of how they practically apply, you know, how the church is to be interdependent with one another, how they associate, but it's not that Baptist joke of, you know, you believe that one jot differently, I push you off the bridge. It's nothing like that. So I just want to make sure I bring that out, make sure that's known. Actually, I remember when I was there at the Trinity Montville Conference, I saw some pastors who were formerly part of ARPGA there, you know, enjoying the fellowship and hanging out with everyone, eating the meals, you know, there the whole time. So I haven't seen it to be true. All right. Quotes on that. Let's hear this from the horse's mouth. While there may have been general uniformity of opinion regarding this question in the 17th century, so one of the issues you have with this is people will say, well, it's in our confession, and we definitely see from our framers who wrote our confession that they definitely believed in formal associations. Here's someone arguing of why that's still not convincing to them, you know, because that is a question of history. It doesn't really answer the question of is it biblical or not. So while this may have been general uniformity of opinion regarding the question in the 17th century, there are many Reformed Baptists today who do not believe that the practice of holding communion via formal associations is scriptural. In addition, there are Reformed Baptists who are undecided on the subject, as well as many who might agree to some degree of formal organization, but balk at such things as the right to hold property, ordain officers, etc. And what he's talking about here is a lot of this issue came out in the modern Reformed Baptist movement really started in the 1960s. And when the churches would meet together for the very first time, a lot of their heart was missions. Like, hey, we all have the same confession. We share the same Christ and the same commission. How can we link arms and do mission works, do some global missions works and whatnot? And some of the debate at that point came down to, you know, someone recognized like, oh, we may need someone to keep the books, like a secretary or things like that. You know, how do we open a bank account to keep these funds? Which church is in charge of that? You know, it came down to methodology, and some people couldn't see an outside organization doing that. Like, from what I've heard, even some of the earliest debates were on, they wanted to buy a typewriter. That way they could, you know, send out, you know, type up letters and things like that. They wanted to buy a typewriter for the missions organization, and some people were just opposed to that because they didn't think that was proper church order. To me, it comes down to a matter of circumstance. I mentioned the regulative principle of worship earlier, how, you know, we know as a church we are supposed to preach the word, right? Well, as a matter of circumstance, okay, it seems to make sense that we would do that at a time when people are awake. So let's do it during the day. We can't do it in the morning because this is the building we have providentially have right now. This is the time we have. So, okay, we're going to do it at 3:00. That's going to be our worship service. We want people to hear the preaching of the word. So we're going to buy microphones. We're going to buy speakers. Is that, of course, that analogy falls apart a little bit. Like, these are circumstances of worship. The microphone, the recording, so we could hear it later to edify the church if they missed it, or to hand out these audios to the church. Those are circumstances of worship. So yeah, the Bible doesn't tell us buy microphones or don't buy microphones. It's just, it's a circumstance. Like, how can we best do this? And so these two sites, their view of the circumstances of how to organize missions, how to edify one another, how to join together, how to do educational things, I think fall on different sides of how they view what circumstances are okay. So the side for formal associations sees like, okay, well, we should open a bank account that's separate from all the churches and have someone else over that. You know, we'll switch out men every year and so on. And that's how ARPCA, you know, kind of runs and whatnot. And other people say like, well, that's, we can't go that far scripturally. We think that's outside the bounds. And so I just want, again, I'm trying to make the point that there are good men on both sides of these issue, and it's a question of methodology. And honestly, I don't know the, you know, you can't lay down one verse and say, nope, it's right here. If you guys just obeyed this, we'd all be good. It is a rather more complicated issue since you're dealing with methodology. But anyways, let's look at the second one. This is, the question becomes, is this confessionally required? Some people will say, yes, this is confessionally required because of how they view this. The other side will say, no, it's not confessionally required because communion, the term communion, doesn't always mean formal groups throughout history. And they'll go back to the original authors of not the Reformed Baptist, not the 1689, but where we got that section of the church, which comes from the Savoy, which was like, again, I don't want to get into all the history and debate. And they'll say, originally, those people did not have formal associations from where the Baptists borrowed this from. Therefore, this doesn't mean that. And there's quotes you can look at back and forth where you see holding communion together means something like a deep pastoral, fraternal, you know, in the spirit fellowship you have with one another, a koine, you know, type of thing, if you will. And the other side says, well, but the Baptists did mean that, and they do say it clearly. So that is the, you know, split on that. But again, that's a question of history. It doesn't ultimately answer the question of, well, what do we actually do then? So he speaks here. This is the pro side, how they view the confession on this point. They speak of the necessity, and this is, he's talking about the paragraph there of holding communion. They speak of the necessity and functioning of associations. Its authors, that is the 1689 authors, are expressing their conviction that churches providentially placed together should associate themselves. There is an oughtness, a duty to this doctrine. And again, the other side will say, well, what did the original authors mean by these words, hold communion? And in this case, that begs the antecedent question, who were the original authors of the words? The Baptists who assembled in London in 1677 borrowed the words from the Congregationalists who framed the Savoy platform and church polity in the year 1658. And I already gave the argument for that, but there you can just kind of see it And that last slide is actually a paper that Pastor David Chansky, he's actually the pastor of Trinity Montville now. He's the one who had, not taken over is the wrong word, but had filled in the gap when Pastor Al Martin retired. Wonderful man. I've sat across from him and had several meals. And actually, when I was in Minnesota, we joined the church that he formerly pastored in Minnesota, and his brother, another Chansky, which they look just alike, and they sound, they have the exact same voice. It's so crazy to see them. He's a deacon there. Or he was. I'm not sure what he is now, but he was still there when we went last month. So again, I know a lot of these men personally. So again, that's why I feel very comfortable knowing that I'm representing them accurately. Of course, they'll be the judge of that ultimately, I guess. But let me see. This last point here. Four associations, communion means formal associations to foster profound spiritual fellowship. The other side, well, yes, profound spiritual fellowship is definitely included, but it's not necessarily needing to be a formal. To give an example of someone who is not in a formal association of how they do this, how they fulfill this, this is Pastor Alan Dunn, again, another man I've met up in Trinity. He says, if you desire interchurch fellowship with our church, then let's get to know each other. Let's learn of each other's ministries and begin to pray for one another. Let's communicate and foster a common interest in the things of the kingdom. Let's take opportunities to deploy our resources to support one another in respective efforts to advance the glory of Christ. Let's trust that the Spirit will direct our obedience and love to the accomplishment of his sovereign purposes. So he's more, because it's an informal way, he's more, and this is where some of the pros and cons come in, is some people who are not for it or have even left the association will say, well, you know, it's a little too institutionalized for my flavor. It didn't feel like it was more spiritually led, if you will. And that's one of the arguments Pastor Alan Dunn makes. He's like, well, you kind of sign these dotted lines and then you just got to kind of meet these churches you don't really know and work with them. And, you know, on my part, I go, well, there's not that many churches, so it's nice to know who there is and to get to know them. You know, that's what a lot of the quarterly meetings of what foster. But again, it's a difference in methodology. Which one's right? Which one's wrong? You know? And here is Pastor Renahan. You know, he ultimately says a lot of the same things, but he's for formal associations. And he says this, it is a reciprocal love, friendship, and support to cooperate together for noble goals, the good and prosperity of all the churches, their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification. By coming together, confessional associations of churches agree to live with one another in order to achieve those goals. When these grow, the church's prosperity, peace, love, and mutual edification, that is, so do the churches and the Christians in them. May God help us to be characterized by these things. There's not much more for me to say about informal associations, and that is because they're informal, so there's not like there's documentation of how they run them. You know, the best I could find was Alan Dunn's. And there are a couple of the pastors who have wrestled with this question when they were asked to join an association, and they gave this answer publicly. They wanted them to know why they couldn't in good conscience do it. So I have several slides, but I'm going to stop here, of selections from the ARPGA and TARBC constitutions. And I thought those would be of interest based on some of the questions I heard last week, because this will get into questions of what powers do they have. I actually read through both of them twice throughout the week, both of their constitutions, just to make sure I'm kind of very well informed and understand how it works. I've also heard the meetings, and I've been to many of the TARBC quarterly meetings and whatnot. So at this point, are there any questions about the holding communion together issue or... because trust me, I could have made that a 5-week presentation. I was really trying to cram it. Anything else on that? Yes, and Ruben's in the back there with those books that I was showing earlier. Associational Churchmanship: Recovering Our Confessional Heritage. This is by Dr. Renahan. This is an excellent. He's handing them out now. I see that hand. No, I was kidding. This is an excellent book that. Dr. Renahan is currently in the process of writing a commentary on the 1689. He is a top-notch historian, and he primarily deals with this document. It is a historical document, and there is a lot you can learn from just the history around it and surrounding it. And he does have a commentary on those two paragraphs we kind of just briefly rushed over. He basically shows how what it means to be part of an association as a church, and it's a lot of those things I mentioned already. Yes, sir. Chapter 26, paragraphs 14 and 15. Oh, did I say 25? Yep, that's an error. Yes. Yes, it's chapters 26. And in this one, he actually goes through chapters 12. I'm sorry. He goes through chapter 26, which is the chapter of the church, and he goes through paragraphs 12 through 15, which deal with membership a little bit and whatnot. Okay, since there's no questions, and we still have 7 minutes, question, blast. No, I was kidding.
Okay.
Oh, I gotcha. So you're just saving your spot. You're first to get the question. That's smart. That's wisdom right there. I like that. All right. So now, again, there's not much more I can say on informal associations unless you have a question about it. So let's look at some of the selections from ARPGA and TARBC. I pulled just pieces together from both their constitutions. I think this will be helpful. So what is the nature of formal associations? This is what they believe about this. This is TARBC. This is the Texas Area Association. The many needs of the churches, such as mutual encouragement and support, assistance of various kinds, edification, oversight when requested and agreed upon by a local church's involvement or by the local churches involved, and cooperative efforts to advance Christ's kingdom in and around the state of Texas brings about the need for an association of churches. Now, one difference that we're going to see in this one versus the ARPGA one is the ARPGA one does not have that statement there of oversight. I can't highlight it there. I should have highlighted it. Oversight, when requested and agreed upon by the local churches involved. So actually when one of the churches in TARBC had heard about some of the issues we had, they reached out to us with this, saying like, hey, if you guys need this oversight part, you know, we have the means and whatnot to provide them. We might talk about that later in a meeting, I'm not sure. So I'll just leave that there. But that's basically for emergency situations where you have no pastor or you need that oversight. And of course, again, because of how we're congregationalist, you know, that has to work. It's detailed later of how that works, and I have that written if we want to see that. But here is the purpose of ARPGA. The purpose of this association is to advance Christ's kingdom by providing a fellowship in which churches of common confession may find mutual encouragement, assistance, edification, and counsel, and may participate in cooperative efforts such as home missions, foreign missions, ministerial training, and publications, all of which are often beyond the scope of one local church. Other such efforts as the association may also deem what will also be brought up is what they say. But so here's something, one of the questions brought up last week was, okay, well, which association, why are there differences? You know, a local state one, from what I have seen, you get the more immediate help. They have more quarterly meetings because you're closer in proximity. There are less churches involved in it, but you get to know those churches really, really well. I know I have, just in all the meetings that I've gone to and all the conferences I've gone to that they have put on. They are also the ones who, it makes sense that they would be the more ones who have that oversight if you ever had that need, because they're, again, in close proximity to you, already know you a lot better than, you know, I forget how many churches are in ARPGA now. I want to say there's somewhere between 60 and 80. In TARBC, last I had counted there, I believe there was 9. I believe Pastor Dell was saying there's one more about to be added, hopefully 2, right? Yeah, just kidding. But one benefit of a more global association or a national association such as ARPGA stands for the American, I'm sorry, Area, Association of Reformed Baptist Churches of America. I got confused at TARBC. ARPGA is that because you have more churches like that, you have more of a pool, you have more opportunity to do home missions, foreign missions, church planning, and whatnot. And those things are still all done according to, you know, our Baptist ecclesiology. The missionaries are sent out from the churches. You know, the church is ultimately responsible for them. But they can be brought up and people can know, like, oh, hey, this church is sending out this missionary. They need this much funds. If you all can contribute, you know, that'd be great and whatnot. And that would be a great way for us to support a missionary that we already know. Hey, we in good conscience agree with these people on, you know, we have the same confession, same methodology. So we know that they're going to preach the commission accurately and rightly, and we can agree with the kind of church they're going to plant. It gives me a lot more assurance than just kind of giving to the general SBC fund where you have seeker sensitivity and whatever. They allow a lot of stuff. So that is one of the benefits. Also, they are recognized by the government as an endorsing agency for military chaplains. They currently endorse 2 chaplains. So that's something an individual church can't do. They do have 5 families involved in world missions, currently in 5 home missionaries, church planters, and whatnot. And they also have 2 indigenous missionaries that they're kind of working with the congregation, depending on how much funds they need, you know, as they're kind of planning the churches. So there's a lot of involvement there. And I think there's actually more families. I think some of them are not, their names aren't published for security reasons due to the countries they're in. So let's keep going. So these are all pretty obvious. These are all things we've gone through, the purpose of TAR-BC. The first point is probably the one, something we haven't talked about yet, but it does show visible unity to the world and the churches. This was, of course, part of Jesus' prayer in John 17 that we would be one so that the world may believe in him. And this is one practical way you can do that. All these other points we've gone through three or four times already. So again, I will link to all this if you want to read this later. Here's a really good one. Point number five, part of the purpose of TAR-BC, again, this local, to detect and deal with heresies and or heretics, and in so doing, maintain harmony and peace in the churches. To give financial aid as God prospers our churches, to help curb the wanton abuse of church power, to cooperate in spreading the gospel, to supply the pulpit to sister churches, so forth, advance Christ's kingdom in every way. And again, we've kind of been those people who attend the association and don't ever formally join. We just, you know, we're like the people who just come, and they don't really take that next step in membership, you know. And thankfully, they have been gracious enough to continue to help us out, even through all the years of us just kind of taking. And it is one question. I know we are a small church, and we might say, well, this does take commitment. There is a commitment to here. You do commit to send messengers with ARPCA. It's once a year. With TAR-BC, they ask that you come at least three out of the four times. And I think one of those times also is a big conference that's really great for the whole church to go to. So there is commitment there, but I think it's good for us, because I think no matter what side you land on, especially, you know, when I looked at all those verses over and what it means that we share the same Christ, the same commission, you know, the same confession and whatnot, we really can be more, we can do a lot more to work together with other churches, you know, whether that be informally or informally, you know, I think we could still be prodded to do that. Again, limitations of powers, this question was asked last week, yeah. All cooperation in associational efforts by member churches shall be strictly voluntary. So again, they have no jurisdiction, it's not a council, there's no popes, there's no bishops like that. The association will make no demands of a member church beyond its purpose of association, which we already read. The association has authority to determine whether it's... Okay, so here is... Presbyterians say this a lot when they analyze our associations. They're like, well, your associations have no teeth. And we go, well, yes, but we believe that's because we could have teeth over us in a kind of, we believe that's non-scriptural and it's wrong. You know, I like the ideas of presbyteries in some regards, but I just don't see it as proper authority. I don't see it. I see how it deals wrongly with the keys of the kingdom. Again, that's a whole other discussion. So what does an association do? What can it do? The association has authority to determine whether its commendation shall be given to or withheld from an applicant church. It also has power to withdraw commendation from a member church. The association cannot take anything from a local church but that which it gives to the church, namely its conscientious commendation. And I remember at one of the first TAR-BC meetings I went to, they had talked about this conscientious commendation. And what they mean by that is, like, I in good conscience, my church can recommend your church. We have analyzed you guys, you know, we've heard your messengers talk and whatnot. And so if, you know, we have a brother move down to your city, we're going to be like, hey, we in good conscience can commend this church and whatnot. And so really when a church either veers away because of doctrine or because of some kind of abuse that doesn't get fixed in the church, then the association can only take away what they've given. Like, okay, we were commending you, now we are not. You know, that's to a lot of the people against formal associations, they see that as too much power. But again, that's why they're making the point, like, we're only taking away what we've given, and it's just a conscientious commendation. Again, I think that's something totally fine, and it makes sense. We are over now, so were there any more questions? Again, I will put all this up. The rest of it, we'll talk about some details of how... and this will be one of the other pluses I would add, how a church that needs to seek advice, how they go about that, and how even an individual member that is part of a church inside an association can go about that. So say the pastor, actually the example they go in here, you know, if you try to go, you know, you should try to go through your pastor first, but if the issue isn't resolved, whatever the conflict isn't resolved, you can go to the association and they'll make the recommendation, they'll give the advice. Again, they can't unchurch a church, they can't unpastor a pastor or anything like that, but they can give their advice. And I think it is very wise for us to have that extra check, if you will, that extra safety net, if you will, to make sure there is no, because there is wanton, there is abuse in the church, there are false teachers. I mean, that's all throughout the New Testament. It's as shocking as it is when it, you know, and it hits home, it's there a lot. And so this is another way for churches to help each other out practically. Yes, sir. Yeah. The first part of the question was benefits and differences between local associations versus the more national one. The national one, I think, from the way I see it, you have a better opportunity to work with foreign missionaries because you have a larger pool of churches working together in that educational. I mean, the Institute for Reformed Baptist Churches that is starting down in Mansfield is part of ARPCA and through ARPCA. And that, you know, one church, especially, you know, Reformed Baptist-sized churches, couldn't do that. And they're pulling together an incredible team, some of the best scholars in the world, in my opinion, regarding those issues. So that is some of the benefits, is the education, the books, the publishing, things that one church can't do. Local associations, the greatest benefit I see is that they get to know you because they're in closer proximity to you. You meet with them more often. And so they would be the first ones I would go to with any questions of, we're having a difficulty in our church, whether it's doctrinal or whether it's a lifestyle thing with whoever, and we can't resolve it in our church alone. We would be the ones to initiate that. First, we would try to do it through the pastors. If that doesn't work, then a member is allowed to go to them and ask them, and they would give that advice. And if it's still not resolved, you know, they mention up here, nevertheless, the association has the right to call any delinquent member churches to account, whether from a wanton abuse of its power towards its members, neglect of attendance at associational meetings, or any deviation from the Word of God and the confession of faith in teaching and practice. If satisfactory reasons are not given by the delinquent member church's pastor for its actions or lack of reformation thereof, the association has the authority to exclude the church from its connection and fellowship. However, this action of exclusion neither disannuls nor destroys the independence of the church. Again, we are still Baptist, so that, you know, at most they can do is give advice and recommendations and take away only what they've given, that conscientious commendation. Are there any other questions before we end? Well, if you do have any other questions, feel free to ask me. Oh, Jeremy. Excellent. I'm glad your question got answered in there. All right. Again, I will make all this available because I know I skipped over like 20 things. That's the main big points about it. Yeah, with that, let's pray.